Welcome, everyone, to Let's Talk About Conversational Intelligence. We are very glad that you joined us on this panel today. And we have a couple housekeeping issues before we get deep into what conversational intelligence is, what does it mean for the localization industry, what does it mean in the world at large. The first thing I would like to note is all the panelists are here under their own free will. The views they express are not the views of the company necessarily that they work for. So please keep that in mind as you hear answers and hear discussion that goes on. These are their personal views, nothing more than that. And I did want to note, we do have a panelist who's here from Microsoft. Microsoft has been in the news a lot recently. And the formal announcement may come out later, but the reason that Bill and Melinda Gates have split is because after all these years, Melinda still doesn't do Windows. At least the panelists giggled. Ta-da! the second piece is we do have a few questions that I'll be proposing to the panelists and facilitating a conversation. A few of them have just met for the first time together today. Panelists, this is more instructions for you. I would like you to give a brief introduction of yourself, but rather than covering your credentials and technical skills and all of those things like all of you have, if you could tell us about how you think about this topic from sort of your origin. What is important about languages and how has it led you to where you're at? Most of our audience, I could say the one common factor they have is language. It's not only speak it, but they're actually working in an industry where language is the top priority. So if we could do introductions in that way, and then as you talk about the answers to questions, feel free to show off and refer to degrees and projects and things like that as much as you want to make your points, and it would be greatly appreciated there. We do have chats running. So if you are attending in the Zoom, please type your questions as we go along our conversation into the chat. If you're live streaming on one of the other platforms, jump in the chat there. Evelyn is going to be feeding those to me, and I'll be trying to incorporate your questions throughout the entire discussion rather than waiting for the end. We want to keep this as natural as possible. So panelists, does that sound like a fun next hour or so for us to spend together? Okay. And did I forget anything that I was supposed to cover there?
Introducing yourself.
Oh, hey, see, this is why Jorge came. So you have to go next since you called me out. So I am Michael Stevens. I am a VP at Translated. As far as my understanding and background of artificial intelligence, I do host a podcast called The Global Podcast. And on that podcast, we've had a number of conversations with people who are leading in this space, especially as it relates to language and conversation. Actually, the person who taught me the term conversational intelligence is on this call and on this panel, so he'll say more about himself. And I am very optimistic that AI is going to lead us to a good place in the world, but it does take good people to stand up and look at the use cases and stand up against the use cases that are poorly. As far as language, a typical American, grew up barely speaking a little Spanish and studying that. And then I studied German and my Spanish got better as I got older. And then in my graduate studies, I studied ancient languages that like 100 people in the world know about nowadays. So a little bit of background there. And it actually gave me the comfort. I had more of a business background in the language piece secondary, and that's how I've ended up where I'm at. So Jorge, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Jorge. I'm not native English native speaker, so I'm actually was born in Spain. Now I'm in the beautiful Malta. And my love for localization started at Amazon. So I was doing localization there as an engineer. And now at a senior, I'm also doing localization. So we are actually, this week, we are launching in Spanish and Portuguese and more languages. And that's how I met Michael, actually. But actually, my real love for localization started when I was very young. So you know, I always wanted to learn programming by myself, so I did it. And all the resources that I was finding was actually in Spanish. Since then, you know, I was very obsessed by learning English, learning other languages, and so on. But what I realized over the time is that language should not be a barrier to connect people. And unfortunately, when you come to products, language tends to be that barrier, where basically your product is not accessible because actually other people cannot understand your product, or even like you cannot reach even more people and produce more business value and solving their problems because your product is not in those languages. So that's why I'm very excited about language, because myself, I have suffered so many times, you know, like getting to calls and suddenly people are speaking in other languages and it's like, oh gosh, like I cannot understand these people.
Or the entire Slack channel of your company is in Italian and you don't speak Italian yet.
Oh, wow. Yeah, good luck with this.
That can happen. That can happen.
I know. It's kind of like, you know, and also, you know, when I started to produce content as a YouTuber, TikToker, whatever you want to call it, I started was focusing on English because I felt like, wow, that's cool. That's what I want to lean towards. And then I realized that there is a huge gap. There is like, you know, most of the time in engineering, in product management, most of the content in Spanish comes way later. And if it comes, so I'm super passionate about removing any barrier.
And I want to put a sort of bookmark on this idea of like social media and engagement and maybe untapped markets, and maybe AI could be helpful there as we talk about this space. Samriddhi, would you mind introducing yourself and giving us your background?
Sure. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Smriti Gupta. I work at Microsoft. I'm currently working in the Teams team at Microsoft. And the name of our organization is actually Intelligent Communications and Conversations in the Cloud. So I'm a data scientist manager. I lead a team of product analytics around that. Considering the background of, I'm not like 100% in the localization industry as of now, but thanks to being in data science space for close to now 11 years, there is no way that you can stay away from that industry, given that if you're operating across different products. So previous to Microsoft, I was working at Broadcom and CA Technologies, and we were dealing a lot with enterprise software in that arena. And localization and internationalization was an important part of enterprise software, making it accessible across the globe, especially in terms of that how little an attention was given towards enterprise software in this particular industry. Because we talk about, you know, conversational intelligence, or we talk about how important it is to ensure that language doesn't act as a barrier, but rather acts as a tool across connecting people. But we do also have an inherent, in these cases, you're inherently catering to the needs of individuals. But here in the enterprise software world, you're catering to the needs of industries, and your clients are actually enterprises overall. That was basically my first brush with the importance of localization and internationalization in a very early on in the career. I think I was right out of my PhD at that point.
You did mention one little fact earlier as we were talking. You were like, I don't have that much experience in this space. I mean, I just have a patent in something, right? Like that's.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That was interestingly in the beginning. I just have a patent on this in this space because I collaborated for one particular project with the internationalization group within our company.
Wonderful.
So the idea over here is, I think more in terms of, I'll go with what is my personal experience. As Jorge has mentioned, I lived in Barcelona. I come from India and I lived in Barcelona for about 8 years. I did my master's, my undergrad, my first job, everything there. And the problem of, you know, having resources in another language and always having, a, you know, some kind of translator attached to your web browser or having the resources in another language and not getting the exact translation has been a problem. I'll say, and the ones who have experienced it will resonate with me far more, especially when you're living in Europe and you're changing languages, like, you know, every 3 hours of train ride and you have a different language on your hand. So I feel that, yes, there is so much of green field of how we can leverage tools like artificial intelligence to make this translation much more human at individual level, as well as, you know, accessible and understandable at the enterprise level. So there is scope, of course, because I have been one of the victims of not having enough of resources about 5 years back or so. But yeah, that's my personal experience why I feel that this industry has so much to offer to individuals.
Excellent. Sebastian, we're saving the best for last, maybe. Vikram, maybe the person who I know the closest. Sebastian, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. Well, disclaimer first, Michael and I are colleagues at Translated. I'm the director of AI at Translated. And I guess, I don't know. Yeah, speaking of myself, I would say I'm an engineer with a strong imprint for multilinguality and linguistic issues. So my family is both French and Austrian. So I grew up bilingual in French and German. And I ended up marrying an Italian academic. We now live in Rome and we've got kids, bilingual kids currently. They're only learning just French, Italian, and obviously English at school. We have left out German from the equation for now, but who knows? And so to me, that meant that early on as a kid, so multilinguality kind of early on started meaning wealth through variety to me. And I think it does to a lot of people who are multilingual, and certainly to people who work in localization. So it's the fact that you've got so many different ways of saying similar but not exactly equal things. It means that there's so many words to name the same things, and all are a bit like butterflies, expressions of the human intellect, but all very varied and all beautiful, different colors and different nuances. And so I approached this from that point of view initially. I liked flipping through dictionaries a lot when I was a kid, I remember. And in fact, the way I approached language technology when I did my engineering studies, and then I studied machine learning, and so it all became sort of more technology driven and practical and everything. But I approached it initially through electronic dictionaries and collections of words. So a bit like a collector, really, a word collector. And I thought, and you know, this was back in the early 2000s, and certainly dictionary-based NLP and language technology was still very much trending at the time. Today, it's a bit different, and I guess we can speak about this now. Now we deconstruct things and we no longer have words, but we have tokens, and everything is statistical, no longer rule driven and so forth. Morphemes and phonemes and everything's gone. Instead, it's all embeddings and continuous vector spaces. So that's brought a lot of changes in the way we do language technology. But in the end, what it really does to people is a lot of what it's been all along. So it's bringing people together. It's bringing access. It's making things accessible in a way that is more direct to people. And yeah, breaking down barriers is one thing when it comes to person-to-person communication, but it's certainly also true when it comes to person-to-content. And I think, seeing that English, the place of English, the ratio of English content to content in other languages on the internet is continuously decreasing, is the beautiful proof that variety is winning there, and that therefore people are gaining more direct access to everything that's out and about on the internet, be it platforms, be it tools that they use, but being also just video, stories, text, news, chat, messaging, and everything. So I guess this is the way, you know, I relate to all these matters, and I'm looking forward to our conversation really today.
I love that theme of wealth through variety. And I think this, for me, is the panel that I've hosted that I've been the most excited about, because we really have multi dimensions on this topic represented here. And that was a desire and a heart of mine, was to have the people who are looking at the same picture from different ways of artificial intelligence and how it relates to conversational intelligence. With that, Vikram, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael. Nice to meet everyone. My name is Vikram Mudgill. I'm based in Seattle. I'm a software engineer by education. And when I started my career about 16, 17 years ago, I got a chance to work in an R&D team. And in this R&D team, there's this Seattle's big luxury retailer. There was a technology VP who came there and he said, "Would you mind helping me out with this problem that I'm having? I want to have some personalization for my customers." And Bluetooth technology wasn't very advanced then. And then, "Can you push your information into a Bluetooth headset?" And that was my first project. And I had to do personalization and I had to learn a new technology, Bluetooth. At the time, wasn't very prominent, at least. There were a lot of issues, security, et cetera. So anyway, that's where I got into statistical understanding and building those models and converting personalization models, et cetera, and sort of fell in love with this.
Did anyone else lose Vikram?
Oh, internet.
This is.
That's because we are using Zoom.
Oh, goodness, says the guy from another competing company. That's perfect. I will just give a little bit of our friendship. Vikram also has founded thegoodai.org. It's a project that brings people together, both those who are practice, those who are just curious about AI, and conversations about how it can be used well. His professional life, that's sort of his I don't know, side jam, side project. I don't know how you call it these days, because we all have so many hats we wear. But his professional life has been around companies that are deploying and using AI in their work. And so he started this other conversation that has been pretty remarkable. Engaging from the leading tech companies to like academic institutions, but even institutions training clergy. I mean, it is just the broad spectrum of people who he has worked with and helped expose and bring into conversation about the future. He's also the guy, he was on our podcast, we have pretty good data for the number of listeners on it. And his episode is like the total outlier for number of downloads, unique downloads. So like, I don't know if he has a bot that he sends and like just keeps downloading it over and over again. I don't know, but it is remarkable to see how his view of the world connects. So hopefully we'll get him back on. I'm going to kind of throw out the first question I have because it seems very pedestrian. If you disagree with it, feel free. And this is not me logging in. This is Vikram. I named everyone after myself in this meeting for those who are watching. We'll get that corrected at some point. But the first question that I had was, is machine translation artificial intelligence? I just want to say that was kind of a softball to you guys because it should be like, no, and then can it be? But I'm going to reframe that a little bit different off of the introductions. I like this idea of using AI as a tool to make things more human. What does that mean to you, especially when it comes around conversational intelligence? What does it mean to use AI as a tool to make things more human? And please don't feel pressured to talk to me, but talk to each other, because that's always more interesting to listen to. That's part of being more human.
Okay, I can start sharing some ideas. So for example, for me, one of the clear problems that we have when it comes to, for example, Google Translate or other machine translation services out there, no, is like the conversations feels very unnatural sometimes and doesn't feel very unique and very like close to you. As a good example of that, we have 24/7 customer support, less than 2 minutes response time, and 50% of or more than 50% of the users of StreamYard comes outside of the US. So it's internationally, and we see that that's expanding more and more and more. So when I would check in some conversation that our customer support has with those people, they are like English native speakers, so they don't necessarily speak Portuguese or speak Spanish. And you can tell that we always solve the questions to our customers, but it doesn't feel very kind of like custom personalized. Feels like a robot talking to you. And that's purely because Zendesk uses like Google Translate and we could use something else. So for me, like the way I would like to see us is like making sometimes machine translations or artificial intelligence could be like a barrier because feels things look like fake and unnatural. And for me, that could be something that I'm looking forward to see how the future leans towards that. I don't know what the other people think about it.
I can take a stab. Actually, that makes sense, Jorge. I feel that overall, in order to add the more human touch and add the more, let's say, context in all seriousness to the translation, you have to have AI models which are helping in this translation that have two inherent qualities, right? Depending on which language or which culture is the recipient of the translation here. One is the sentiment of translation, which is not something that is a word-to-word translation answer. So yes, we can have models and we have had models that help you translate, and it's not new. There's no rocket science anymore behind it, that we have translation from language A to language B and the word-to-word translations do happen. But I think one piece is the sentiment conveyed in one language for the same words is much different from the sentiment conveyed in the other language and with the same words, right? Like, it's just the fierceness of different languages are there, the fierceness of cultures are different, and just the whole intake is quite wide.
And in order to gather that model, this sentiment analysis that's being done currently of like tweets and different things and people rating them of how they feel, like that's the sort of data set you need in order to incorporate that into an AI language model. Is that correct?
Sure, there's no one right or wrong answer over here, Michael, I believe. So I think here we are talking about other dimensions. What does exist in the ecosystem through hashtags and so on, they are like standard sentiment analysis model. I mean, Twitter has done a great job in developing those. But I feel that there's another element to it, which is purely in the translation industry, right? And that is something which goes beyond just understanding the sentiment of one particular hashtag. This is more about real-time translation and understanding the sentiment behind a sentence when it's conveyed by a person having a particular culture and having coming from a particular mother tongue. And then the other part of the same thing is one is sentiment, the other piece I believe is context associated. And both of these kind of are so inherent to the translation or making sense out of and not being, you know, lost in translation, quote unquote, from the movie, right? And not getting there. So context is another important issue, I believe, that, you know, and context comes more from the culture, but it also comes more from what kind of piece are we looking into from translation standpoint. So the context when it comes to conversational AI is very different as compared to context when it comes to if you're trying to translate a software or you're looking into the comments in a software, right? So how much of emotion is attached to it? So the context has to come from there. How much of sentiment is attached to it is the producer of the content, which has to come from there. So I believe that there are quite a few interesting pieces there which can add human touch to the basic translation. Different industries have probably have had different level of maturities across it.
I have one more question on that. With context, context is such a broad bucket to use for that. Because we talked a little bit about history, right? The history of a place or a name or something, that would be a context. What, like, how do you define context?
So as I said, right, like context is associated with the kind of verbals you're translating across. So if I'm talking about a cultural part a cultural tour guide or something, some software which is dealing with that, yes, the context is associated with the history of the place, you know. But then there is other part of it that when we are talking about pieces where you don't have that much of emotional piece attached to it. So it's a very professional, it's a business readout, for example. Your context is like when you're saying when you're saying a word like this is aggressive, you actually mean aggressive. There's no like different level of aggression that you're looking at, right? So it's more about the context as in, I believe that subject matter plays a very important role when we are really trying to, you know, instrument human technology into the translation.
And Sebastian, I'm going to kind of call on you, even though I'd love this conversation, but there was one project we worked on that I think had sort of a first level order it was delivering on, but there's a deeper level because it has a theological context to it. And this is the work that we did at the Vatican for the Pope's secret archive. Can you tell a little bit about that work?
Yeah, so, okay, well, So this is work we did at another company in Pi Campus, Pi Campus being the venture fund that's attached to Translated. This project was indeed conducted on material from the Vatican Secret Archive, which is essentially a private archive of the Pope, which holds his personal, like professional official correspondence.
And it would be like journals and diaries and that sort of materials?
Correspondence and notes and registry, like diaries, but it's kind of like, you know, papacy is an entire, it's not just one person, it's really an office. And so, the project was about developing optical character recognition for medieval Latin scripts in which a part of these archives are written in. And we did this, at the time we did this, this was back in 2017, and it's now been turned into a full-fledged research project. But when we started it off, it was a small thing. It was a project that we did together with people from Google Brain, who helped us adapt the TensorFlow deep learning framework in order to be able to do OCR on that material. And so you're saying provocatively, Michael, that there's this theological...
You take the first level that we need to get is it needs to be readable, right? There's so much data there that it's not even readable. So we can solve that problem with the technology we have. The next one is taking the data set of theological evolution and throwing that against what is now readable, and then you can suddenly start to build context. Does that...
Okay, I mean, I suppose for many people on Earth, religious context is a very important way of grounding conversations. Many Western cultures are sort of looking down on religion and try and take out religion from personal exchange and certainly from commercial exchange. But that's not true in a lot of the world's regular person-to-person conversations. Mm-hmm. And as such, I would say, yes, religious grounding and sort of religious references are certainly a very important part of regular human-to-human conversations. And as such, these are things that need to be taken care of by any AI that, you know, at least pretends or intends to facilitate that conversation. And, well, surely together with, you know, philosophical grounding and sort of like an intellectual grounding, these things, background, educational background, these are probably the the elements of context which are most out of reach, like hardest to model and to get right for, well, I'll call it technology for now. I won't use the term AI to not, you know, seem like I'm saying this is any intelligent, like technology is any intelligent or something. I just say this is technology. So coming back to your question from, you know, the question that you asked at the beginning, and also Jorge's sort of reaction to it, which was, he said, you know, how does Akan AI help make things more human, or does it, and so forth. And Jorge pointed out, well, in many real practical circumstances in which AI is put into use, or language technology is put into use, actually has the opposite effect of dehumanizing and making things seem rough or unnatural. And I agree, and I have a, you know, my own personal take on the reason why is that, you know, let's not be blind that there are commercial interests in automating, you know, and using technology instead of other humans to make these things happen. There's therefore also an incentive to maybe use technology before it's at the degree of naturalness than any of us would want to use for their own personal usage if they were given the choice. And so that means, you know, I'm saying, but why do we use technology when it's not mature enough? It's a difficult road that, you know, engineers are walking, making this technology be invisible, be seamless enough that you don't notice it and that it's totally natural. This is really hard. And so, well, if we start using it before it's kind of like ready for prime time, then it will be rough and it will be a bit funny, and there will be this effect of the uncanny valley where it's almost there, but for some reason it's weird. We will have that. And so, you know, it's just a consequence of other choices and other incentives, I would say, that come into play. Let's just not ignore them. Let's just, you know, acknowledge them. That's what I would say about this.
I do think framing this, there's a lot of conversation out there around barriers, and I think that's relevant. And we've all experienced those and hit those. If as humans, we're going to solve the great challenges of our time and future that we don't even know yet, if we can't have understanding of each other, if I can't be understood and have understanding for someone else, there's no way we could even have a real conversation about climate, energy, going to Mars, all of these sort of headline topics that people are promoting. And that's where I think the real value that was mentioned of sentiment. What is the emotional luggage that's being communicated, emotional token that's being communicated to another individual in that moment, and context? And those are beautiful applications of AI. When I talk about AI in that space, I'm not scared at all. I'm scared when someone's trying to sell me soap using those things. But when I'm working with another human who comes from a very different background and I can have a tool that helps me understand them better, I get excited.
I was just going to make a small point around context, that context is, and I think it's been covered later on as well, that context in a conversation of, let's say, a few minutes, it is moving and shifting, and you need to, I think AI systems need to keep a track of context. Just understanding is not enough. Tracking it is very important. And that was just a small point that I wanted to make. And it is very hard. Because yes, you can translate one sentence, you can translate a paragraph, a document, but human conversations, we're talking about weather, suddenly we're talking about politics, and suddenly we're talking about something else. How do you keep up with that?
Yeah, and Vikram, sort of explore a little more, anyone on the panel, what does tracking look like?
You know, first of all, the most important aspect around tracking is the fact that, do you understand the nuances, the styles, and you know, those finer elements, which a lot of AI systems don't. I mean, most of AI systems are focused on, you know, a sentence or the span of 60 seconds of buffering or whatever the buffering technology is. So they're not designed or intentionally maybe to look at long running conversations, for example. So tracking a context over a period of time, it just basically means that, are you understanding that there is a shift in the conversation? Are you understanding that this is a new topic? There is a new sentiment. The sentiment just suddenly changed when you talked about discounts, for example, in a contact center example that was given earlier. So how do you keep track of these changes in a conversation and those variations?
But actually, I have a question for you. I'm like, you guys know AI, like I'm very new into this, but for example, like, if we are in conversation, like in chatbots, I can understand chatbot is like next level is even harder. But if we just think from Google Translate, a product itself, I was thinking like, you know, maybe Google can not necessarily create a specific model for your application, but can say like, oh, Stringyard, what are the competitors based on like similar websites? Who are similar products like YouTube, Facebook, stuff like that? And based on that, Google will inherently understand like broadcast is translated in these multiple ways in those multiple places, and they can actually come in up with something that makes more sense. While what I'm seeing now is like sometimes they don't fully get it, and it's not so I can understand like without like talking more specifically in like the hard problem about like having a human conversation itself, why sometimes it's simplest things like a product translation, which is kind of like understanding multiple variables, but it's kind of like more predictable in that sense. It's even lacking that sort of like context specific thing.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say is that there is, it's a little easier and simpler to track context when it is action-based, right? And context is based on what you're doing. Are you clicking on this? Are you watching this ad or things of that nature? It is relatively simpler to sort of track the transactional context, which is, because that data is available and you don't need to know language, you don't need to know anything there. You just need to have systems in place to which are able to track that. But conversation is much harder. I've been in situations where for a multinational, over 100-year-old company making toothpaste, they even call the products differently in different countries. Right? Fabulous White is Fabuloso, and that's not the customer, but I'm just giving examples. It just comes to mind. But in different countries, even these names are more customized and localized. Oreo brand in India is called something totally different. I think there's a totally different name there. So sometimes there is just marketing and everything else is also tuned and changed completely. So a simple translation will not give you the context.
Yeah, and generally speaking, context building in conversation, it's a hard problem. It's not an easy problem. Because think about it, how you develop AI models, machine learning models, rather. You develop it because you have data and you can, you are able to kind of create, mappings between A and B because you have so much of experience of seeing A being mapped to B. In this case, in case of conversation, as Vikram mentioned, like you have a human touch involved. Like, hey, I have been told, like, I think the other day I was looking into the way Google has done, like if you type Michelle Obama and then, it shows, and then you just type her age and then, it'll give Michelle Obama's age. So it has developed a context that you're asking about the same person's age, right? And this is a very small example of the fact that you could relate your previous sentence with the next sentence. But if you keep on changing this in terms of conversation that, hey, Jorge, the background is looking very interesting. So you're from Mexico, so things like that, right? So that's an orthogonal change. And how exactly mm-hmm. are you training your systems? And to be honest, like I do believe that tech has to be deployed and tested constantly in order for us to make improvement. We cannot have a whole built up product in the market thinking that, hey, this is gonna solve the crisis that is next to an originator or whatever. But the point being that context building is one of those problems that requires so much of you know, levels of testing and deployment and running over real world environment and it's a hard problem. We have come far along in AI, and still this is a problem which still exists, right? So, I mean, generally speaking, there's so many dimensions to it. As long as it's transactional, it's very easy to, well, it's more straightforward to tackle. I'll not say easy to tackle. But as long as it goes beyond transaction, you have much more complex models, the models that cannot be defined. I'll give you a little example. I remember that way back I was writing, like in my undergrads or grad school something, I was writing an application for scholarship. And I wrote the entire application, and I think at the end I realized that I have to submit it in Spanish or Catalan because I was in Barcelona. And interestingly, desperate times require desperate measures, and the deadline was the very next day. I ended up using Google Translator, and I shoved it out like, okay, this is done. Later on, I got one of my close friends, and I was like, "Hey, did I submit it right? Do you think I have good chances of getting this?" And you know, the expressions were interesting. She was like, "You know what happened? So I had written something like there were three rows of There were three rows of objects that I had translated, something like that." And it converted it into tres filas. And the context was something like, you know, filas are like the queues of people, which is like, it just changed the entire application's context. And well, lo and behold, I lost it. But the point being that I could not rely on it because the context could not be essentially drawn out of the automated translator. I'll pause here. I think I'm speaking a lot.
It's a fascinating, but then also, again, some of the details of that, the objects and things like that, I can nod and pretend like I know, but the context is also a political context in which you're submitting it, where you're having to do it in Catalan. And so, yes, you can get the language done, and maybe we can talk about a translation failure, but even worse is the person who's reviewing it in Catalan goes, this person doesn't care about us. We've not been cared about for how many years? We've been oppressed. Ah, forget, there's no way she's getting this. It's context can be so weird. And if we do it in the way that we can imagine, then the fact that we could create simulations that are ubiquitous to real life.
I have a question, Michael. I have a question because, so for me, it's very, if you ask me now, you know, like we are onboarding the translators and we are creating all the internationalization pipeline. For me, talking about context could be very straightforward, no? Like screenshots of the product, widget with the in-context translation so you can actually see the product live, context about the company, our values, etc. But I would be curious to ask Sebastian or anyone else in the panel, like, what other context about the political stuff that Michael was talking about is more relevant when we are talking about this type of conversations? Like what, like if you could think about like in the ideal world, what is the best context that you can get for any sort of like machine learning system that we are talking about?
The real answer is horrible. Everything.
Yeah, and you know, Hari, I want to just quickly share my thoughts here. So I think the fundamental thing is that we have to think of document understanding and conversational understanding as two separate things. They're not the same at all. There is document, no matter how unstructured you can be, you will still have a structure. The context will be provided and you're not just going to be all over the place, unlike humans, which are less programmable and at least until now. So you can't program humans to follow a structure, and we can be very fluid. We can still understand each other no matter how abstractively we are talking and you know, the way you know, we use certain, I guess, cultural nuances there. It's easy for another human to understand. In fact, I would tell you a space where, you know, I'll say something which you will not know what it means, but you'll know exactly what I mean. So an example is Trooper 10, go to Sector 18. What does that mean? Do we all understand what I'm saying? I think we all do. But you don't know what Trooper 10 is or who, and then what a Sector 18 is. but you still understand, you know, it's without any context. So sometimes, you know, we have to sort of look at these things slightly differently, a context in a documentation relatively more straightforward in a legal document, for example, if you're looking at that, there is certain structure that it follows. An email follows a certain structure, even though highly unstructured medium of conversation. Chats between humans are slightly different from a conversation.
So let's pull it in a bit to the enterprise. Samridi was mentioning that earlier. For focusing on enterprise, that's a context that is more limited and helpful for us. I want to do the kind of super geek thing here for a minute. There are certain computational limits we run up against currently. When do you see some of those being overcome for our audience? What are they? Can someone sort of describe for people who may be logging in who don't sort of know what effect computing power has on this conversation?
In fact, I wanted to comment on this earlier. I think it's kind of like defining otherwise our conversation here about these things is kind of like very abstract. Maybe it's in order to just give a few hints about how context representation works in language technology today. So I'll just try and give a few ideas here, left and right. So in machine translation, context is represented by, as it says etymologically, by the text that is around that one sentence that we're trying to translate. And that is the very first degree of context representation that machine translation software actually uses, right? So it's the sentence before, it's the sentence after, it's the text around in a very same document. And that's degree one. Beyond that, what is currently used in language technology and in machine translation software, certainly in the one that we use at Translated and so forth, is the rest of the text that has been written on a similar topic and that is available to, you know, the kind of corpus that is available to that translation software. And that represents a wealth of text. And it is relevant because it uses the same kind of terminology. And that's, again, you know, specifically in the enterprise applications, it's relevant that registry, style, maybe tone of voice is the same as the one that is represented by, I don't know, translating for a big corporate. They certainly have their own tone of voice defined in a style guide, okay? And that is embodied in some of the other text that has been written and translated for that company. Okay, and that's degree two. And what I meant a bit sort of jokingly, like tongue in cheek earlier on when I answered to Jorge, it's everything, is that then, you know, degree three and upwards from there, the bits that are, I would say, hardly used in language technology nowadays. So it starts from, I mean, degree three, you could say it's all the rest of the text that has been written and that has been used as training material for a translation engine. And here I'm just speaking about machine translation software. So all the text that it's seen, okay, in all languages, and that represents, you know, even bigger context. And it is still relevant because, speaking, for instance, of the linguistic problem of word senses ambiguation, seeing occurrences of different word senses appear in a large corpus of text, well, that tells you that a given word, you know, prototypical example would be bank, river bank in the institution, or whatever, pen, the dog's pen and you know, the pen to write and all these things. And very easy to understand, but if you look at it, then the phenomenon is much more widespread and you figure out that, you know, if you open a dictionary, then every single word actually has got several definitions because, hey, it's got all these senses. Okay, and so in a very large corpus encompassing all the material that a given translation engine has seen, well, you see examples of these senses. And this is why for word senses ambiguation or making sense of different senses that are attached to a given, you know, word, say lexeme to be technically precise, you need all that context. And without it, you can't work, or you're missing on some of the senses because you haven't seen them. And then degree four and beyond is everything that's been said or written by humanity, and that's just not accessible to that system. And I would say currently, you know, we're limited to degree three, because that's what's limited, what's accessible to that system. That's what we managed to do. The thing that we managed to do much better is degree two, and even more so degree one. So the immediate context, we know how to represent this and how to encode this really well. And again, this is just a glimpse on how it works today, 2021, and it didn't used to work like this, I don't know, like 10 years ago. Surely in 2031, you know, we'll be way beyond that. But maybe that helps, yeah, ground the conversation a little bit. And maybe later on in the conversation, we can speak about chatbots and the way that context is represented there, but that's another story then.
Right. Yeah. So on this, Michael, I know I have to just jump out, but just wanted to share a white paper that I came across recently, which attempted to calculate the floating point operations per second, the flops that humans can calculate per second, right? What is the level of calculations that humans can do, talking about computation here. So the comparison was, yeah, we probably are computing at 10 to the power 17. I mean, there is argument between 10 to the power 13 or 10 to the power 17, whatever billion, trillion it is. So it's a very large number of computations that humans can do per second. And then in this paper, they also covered that V100s actually today can do 10 to the power 13 calculations today as of right now. And it costs $10,000 to own that kind of computation power. But the upper end of that, which is 10 to the power 17, there's a supercomputer called Fugaku. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but this supercomputer costs $1 billion and it can do 10 to the power 17.
It's the orders of magnitude playing out for us there.
That's just to stay within the human range of computation, right? So it's not just about computation, really, because these computers are not nearly
behind. That's great context. Yeah. Well, Vikram does have to leave. For those of you who want to learn more about him, check out the Global Podcast's most well-performing episode, which he spoke. Simple.ai is the business he represents. So, yeah, thank you for joining us for this time. It's like Clubhouse. He's going to leave the stage now. The rest of us will still be here if we can call someone else. We do want to call you all up to the stage. Please send your questions. We'd love to hear what you're thinking and what this has inspired from you. Sorry, we can't physically have you come up or digitally. I don't even know how to describe what that does. But the Clubhouse thing, you got it. One question we did get. What benefits have you seen, and what benefits do you anticipate for people using AI? And we can frame it within enterprise and conversational intelligence, but if there are other places you think are applicable, please share those.
Well, I can think one applicable is for example, Salesforce is doing, or other software are doing, where basically they record a conversation, they transcribe the conversation, and they can get data points out of that conversation. I think for improving the sales funnel, having better leads, improving the salespeople as well, I think that's an application that I've seen of the AI doing quite well, and I'm very impressed by that in particular.
I'm grateful for my spam filter, a wonderful application of machine learning, a pretty ancient one by nowadays standards, but it shows how, you've got villains and then you've got the goodies. We use technology to try and fix what villains are doing. And some days goodies are winning, some days villains are winning instead. So I'm grateful that some of the goodies are using that technology to make the world a better place.
I mean, if the question is for AI in general, there are like so many areas where we are touching upon in everyday life where we are using it. And same what Sebastian mentioned, like there's so many areas where we are doing like, you know, removing goodies from the villains. I think I know there's a There's two different views when it comes to recommendations, but I personally find recommendations in many of the contexts very very interesting and very helpful for me. Whether it's for buying my next thing on Amazon, or if it's like understanding which is the next game I should play, or is it understanding like where should I go for vacations next, and wherever like, of course, I mean, I am a huge believer of ensuring data privacy, but this is always within the limits of what I allow a platform to leverage my data for. And I have been generally very very happy with the fact that you know, in general, like, there's a plethora of information on internet, and just to find the information that's relevant for you, it's not an easy problem. So there can be other extreme of it, to what Michael said in the beginning, that, hey, I don't want you to sell everything to me. But there is one extreme of it, which is, hey, I need my relevant things which are relevant to me, and I don't want to all the time enter my information that, hey, I like hiking and I like swimming, and so suggest me a place like this. So that's something which I have found, you know, ease of life. And even nowadays, I really like, in a lot of these map applications, it tells us things like, you know, hey, this is the restaurant you might like. And more often than not, I usually like those restaurants. So.
Or even like very small things. Well, not as small things, because they are very complex, but to know like how long it's going to take you to get to one certain place. For me, like, that's how I schedule myself most of the times. And on top of that, from the events and live streaming industry, which is what I'm like die every single day for, I think like the TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn Live, the auto captioning is incredible. And most of the people now, well, not most of the people, but there is a huge percentage of the people that consume content without audio, because maybe they are in class, maybe they are on transit, maybe yeah. They are doing something else. So I find that very exciting. And even like TikTok released recently Japanese and English auto captioning. And the time where more people are going to do that is going to be incredible. Even the other day, you know, like there is this big, massive musical event called Eurovision, where all the countries in Europe plus some others come and play, and it's multicultural. There was one of the participants that I was watching a documentary about her. It was in Ukrainian. I didn't understand anything, but glad YouTube has auto captioning. And I discovered a very emotional story about that person in particular. So thanks to that feature in particular, I was able to connect and discover someone that otherwise I could probably miss and get inspiration from. Those are the things that for me, from a human connection point of view, more than ever, I think technology, AI, and language captioning is making us more closer.
And on that note, actually, just I wanted to add one thought to what Jorge said. I think it's also not only bringing people together, but also enabling a lot of people who would otherwise not be able to participate, right? Like, if you are here, like, if there is an audience member who have hearing impairment, and, you know, things like being able to connect because of different language and so on, I think these technologies are not only helping make life better, but also like enabling a broader participation of audience, and enabling more conversations from different from different angles.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I would even say that the concept of digital divide or digital gap is really testimony to what you're saying, because it says, oh, we're, you know, a part of the population, or some people are left out of this bounty, and that's unfair, which obviously is true. But the fact that this concept started appearing, I guess, just points to the fact that, yes, there is this richness, there is this wealth in being able to participate in some global dialogues, in accessing this content that's otherwise beyond reach, in being able to entertain yourselves this or that way, or educate yourselves this or that way, or interact with other people in that particular way. I mean, all these things, are made possible by, you know, largely by AI technology. And the fact that this digital divide concept exists says, yes, it is so. And it's really good that it exists on the side, you know, of those who are, have access to it, mm-hmm. obviously without that there are those who don't.
I think I so focus on the technology itself, I often forget how desperate people are to connect, right? Like that, you understanding the Ukrainian, the accessibility piece, all of that is, we overcome a lot of these barriers because of our natural instincts or programming, whatever you want to call it, to get to that place of understanding other people. With that, Michael Reed on LinkedIn asked a great question. We got a couple questions here that I'd like to run through. I will start at the bottom of it, and then if you need more context, but I think the final one is really concise. Will people be allowed to interact in international spaces in their own language, or will English continue to be the necessary condition of access?
I think it's actually kind of like the opposite, no? I think for so long, English has been the main primary language that everybody should learn and understand. And I think more and more, and I think Sebastian was talking about it at the beginning, like we see the trend that is actually flipping, no? It's like English is like the first world-class citizen, but I see other languages also becoming to the picture. So I think it's... maybe we could talk about like, should we have like a generic language for every humans to interact and communicate? But no, actually I feel like it's the opposite. It's like the more communities solidify, the more content and the more matured industries become. And like, even for example, as an example, in Latin America, you start seeing a lot of startups and a lot of people that are actually creating a huge economy in those countries. So while I always tell anyone asking me like, oh, I want to get into technology, should I learn English? I always say, please do so. At the same time, I'm very hopeful that over the time that will become less important, because we will have so many tools out there that actually will make that very seamless. Well, you got it. I don't know what the other people think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. And I also do feel that, we as a, like just looking at us as a group, we're talking in English. If this podcast or this panel was happening in another language, the question would be, hey, is it important to learn English, or are we good with speaking in whatever language you're talking in? So the point is that I think there's an inherent bias towards the language in the community that you're talking with, right? Living in different, like, this is the 10th, Seattle is the 10th city I'm actually living in, and living in different cities of the world, you know, like you kind of realize that there are multiple places you can get along without knowing English, right? So it's not like the bread and butter of everything.
Except Japan. Japan is horrible, as far as I know.
So the point being that I do believe that the world is shifting, and I don't think that language in itself is a real barrier given the way the tech is evolving. But obviously, I mean, no matter what, I always think that being a multilingual is always an ammunition in your back pocket, right?
Also, just a quick note on top of that, because I fully agree with that. I actually feel like we should all check our own biases. Because when I'm creating products, I always go like, no, I should create this product in English. And then I realized that I've tried with different products, like to go to a Spanish market and to go to different markets first. And actually was like, oh, actually, there is a need, because everybody's building products for English and nobody's building products.
It can redefine the TAM. It can redefine the total addressable market when we think about products. If you, again, it's multidimensional. It's not a line. It's not a point. We're talking about at least 10 dimensionalities, if not hundreds. And how do you slice that? I don't know. So what I took away from your answers, though, are yes, but maybe. Like, yes, but maybe the communities will be...
Let's be honest. Short term, medium term, maybe 10 years, 15 years, English will become what it is right now. But the more, like, those people... Like, even if you realize China... Like they have their own applications, they have their own markets, they are huge. And if they don't want to, they don't need actually to interact with the rest of the world.
If TV has taught me anything, the show Firefly, for those fans of the sci-fi, yes, everyone in the galaxy spoke English, but when you swore, it was in Chinese. So maybe that's what the future looks like. I don't know. If TV informs the reality we live in, then maybe true. This is a question, it may take us the rest of the time that was asked by a panelist, by somebody writing in. And I'm gonna frame it a little different. I probably frame it both ways. He says the study, he's referring to a study from Yale that argues that artificial intelligence is neither artificial nor particularly intelligent. A fascinating history of the data on which machine learning systems are trained. And that's a quote from the New Yorker. I think others have said it a little differently. They've said that the difference between machine learning and AI, if it's written in Python, it's probably machine learning. If it's written in PowerPoint, it's probably AI. That's Matt Valesso. And then I heard the follow-up that is, if it's written in blood, it's probably Skynet. Again, sticking to the movie's themes. People now in the localization industry are referring to machine translation as AI, as it stands. Because I'm an optimist, I don't mind that misuse of language. I think we need to be smart enough to say, no, this is not AI, but we're aspirational in saying we can see how it can be. That's my layman's view of it. What do you guys think as people who have delved deep into the halls around this?
I mean, so I'll give you my take, and it's just very down to earth, I would say. It's a matter of senses. AI, the way we use it nowadays, it's got at least two senses. Let's just be completely transparent about it. One way is indeed the way we use it in PowerPoints, and it refers to basically any technology that uses current shapes of machine learning plus human data and has to do with speech, language, natural language processing, especially in vision. And so it refers to a technology, to a tool. And that's sense number one. And then you have sense number two, which is the philosophical thing, which is intelligence, but in an artificial form. And that's completely different.
And Sebastian, it's not the Turing test, right? Because that's settled.
The
Turing test to measure artificial intelligence. Can you be fooled by machine thinking it's a human? Like clearly machines fool humans every day thinking that they're not machines.
Yeah. So
that was a very low bar for what artificial intelligence could be.
Well, it was a very high bar in the 50s when it was formulated.
Yes, absolutely.
And instantiations of it lower the bar in a way, because what Turing had in mind initially is not necessary that you have a 20-minute conversation over a keyboard and windows of text appearing, and then you have as a judge you have to decide whether this was a machine or a human. I mean, this is lowering the bar quite a bit, right? What he had in mind is having a conversation. I mean, it could be through means, technical means, whatever, but it means having a proper conversation that allows you to test and instead of probe what you have in front of you in terms of an entity and then decide. So, okay, just to give a bit more credit to the idea that Alan Turing originally had. So, but I just wanted to make clear, okay, so you have these two senses, let's just not be blind about the fact that we are using them in those two ways. And obviously there's a vested interest to who sells AI in sense one to make it sound like it's AI in the sense two, but it's just two very different things. And so here we go, okay? So machine translation is AI in sense number one, because that's the way people have decided to use the word AI nowadays. But it's clearly neither intelligent, you might claim it's artificial though, but it has nothing, has very little to do with intelligence, and that's it. So to me, the debate is no longer irking. We're over that. There are two senses that people use, at least these two. I mean, let's get over it and speak about the really interesting bit, which is how do we get there? And once we are there, then what's in it for us? So So in fact, at the beginning of the week, when I was thinking about our conversation today, I was thinking, you know, one thing that I find really sort of titillating about the entire idea of conversational intelligence, especially the artificial part of it, is what happens when we get to a superhuman level in dialogue, okay, in conversation? What happens when machines become better than humans at dialogue? And, you know, this is, you know, it might sound outlandish if you're like sort of more on the philosophical side, but if you look at technological development, then you might think, okay, there's human parity in a number of tasks in AI technology already. And so why not in dialogue one day? And presumably it's closer than we think. And what I wanted to throw as a question to you guys is, well, what do you think superhuman performance in dialogue will look like when we have it?
I largely agree with you, Sebastian, because the conversation of whether it's artificial or whether it's intelligence, I think it's that I do agree that it's more of a philosophical thing. Because what is intelligence? If you're saying that you're intelligent, what does this really mean? Right? Like, because what we are trying to do with AI or machine learning from the tooling perspective is essentially that we're just trying to process a large amount of data to sound intelligent. And that's nothing different from what you would do if you're intelligent, right? Like if you have a prodigy who's like you know 2-year-old child who can speak 12 languages, that's not possible, right? But what is it that the child will do? The child will have like bunch of probably like inhuman sort of experiences in his head that he or she can process and is delivering that particular piece. And that's what we are trying to emulate with supercomputers or whatever artificial intelligence is ready to deliver. So I do agree that, you know, the fact that we are called, the debate doesn't make much sense that, hey, whether it's artificial or whether it's intelligence and all these things, because it's about, it'll land back to perspective. What is intelligence, right? And to the other point that, how exactly, like when you're having this conversation, what is superhuman part of it? Because that will make you super intelligent in this case, right? So if I'm able to process, I don't know, like plethora of data, whatever is available on the internet, if I'm able to process it while Michael, you ask me a question and I'm going to tell you like, you know, yes, there are 20 different papers on this and 30 different publications on it and 20 different books written on it. Am I sounding intelligent? No, but just my search engine is better than yours, probably. So it's more of it like how we tackle the fact that, yes, computation is one part of the story, but also how nice are our algorithms for computation? How much we are emulating human intelligence through our algorithms or emulating the emulating what is desired of an output in these algorithms. I think that is the crux of whatever is intelligent over here.
Well, yeah, I'm gonna probably say, and so I agree with all of you. So anytime that I read someone doing those type of jokes, like oh, he say yeah, intelligent, blah blah, I'm always very kind of like skeptical with those people. And it's like if as like humans we cannot agree about so many things like what is intelligence and many other things in the world, the debate shouldn't be there. The question shouldn't be like, oh, is AI intelligent and smart? Or doesn't matter. Like what really matters is AI making us better? What's going to look like the future once we keep developing those, once we put more resources, once we put more people investing money into that? And how is that going to solve problems for us? And it's like in engineering, there are always so many debates around so many things that are useless because people like to debate on things that deviate the conversation from the most important thing, which is, are you going to contribute to that? Is this making you better? Do you like it? Because otherwise, you know, there will be those people that will go against AI and so many other things just because either they don't understand, either they don't necessarily, they are afraid of that, afraid as any other changed. And I think we should give it more time to that. And we should put more the conversation towards what you are going to do to contribute to that. Or as a society, Are you going to be a blocker or are you going to be an enabler? And for any new revolution, for any new inventions, we should all be enablers and not be a blockers and deviate the conversation from the important things.
I think super intelligence looks like the sarcasm detector. I clearly like to joke around with people. I clearly like that sort of environment. Sometimes that is destructive. And so if I had some way to have assistance to see people's micro expressions, to understand their heart rates, those things, I would know, oh my goodness, this is falling like a lead brick and I need to walk away or I need to settle down. Take it to the other level for people in tense communications where things could become violent. If you're able to sort of give data tools, things in the moment to decrease violence between individuals, I think that would be super intelligent and a great part of
it. You know, Michael, what could be amazing for me, and this is actually a project that, thanks to this project, I got a scholarship in China, but I call this my second brain. So the idea of that is actually that a machine where you are at home or anywhere, and the machine can detect who you, how are you feeling, and based on that, take decisions like, oh, it feels like you didn't have a good day today at job. I'm going to call your friends, or I'm going to buy you pizza, or I'm going to do this that.
So. The Aura Ring does that to some extent, right? Every morning I wake up and I see my readiness score. So I can go, oh, my score is low today. I should tone down my humor. Like, that's literally part of my morning process. I'm not quite myself.
But you know what is very funny is like, sometimes you can be manipulated and all of us can be manipulated so easy that I could be scared, like based on a machine data, you could be behaving one way or the other, no? Because I can totally manipulate that, tells you that, oh, wow, you're going to crush it. And you actually feel it, even though maybe you feel like, oh, okay, but the machine is telling me that. So we need to be very careful with that, I feel. But
I would like to close with a brief answer the thoughts that you guys have. Our community here through Multilingual may have questions. They're learners. And so some of you have graduated with PhDs from top universities in the world. Others of us are just playing around here. But where would you recommend sort of the average person go to learn more? And what are places where you think are doing some of the most groundbreaking research?
I'll give it a stab. I'll give mine at least. So mine will be a pretty pragmatic one. I think in discourse, also in public and media discourse about the topics we've been conversing about today. Well, there's a lot of fluff, and also there's a lot of non-fluff, but which is philosophical debate. So it's important to be able to tell these two things apart from what exists, what is feasible in the short term, what has been done. And I think grounding your thinking in indeed the concrete, as opposed to the abstract, the debatable, the moot, this is something that as a learner will make you, well, will give you a better understanding or and make you able to participate in the debate in a much more informed way. As a consequence of this, my advice or my kind of like take on this is to focus learning on what there concretely is. Entertain a bit less of the philosophical and of the hair splitting and of the, you know, debate kind of things, and look at what there is. Also in a quantitative fashion, understand that, you know, we were mentioning before the place of English on internet content. I was thinking, okay, so it does help to realize that 20 years ago, it was at, I think the number is 41%, it's down to 26% in 2020. And so it's no longer, you know, a very large language, but numbers tell you that then, you know, the distribution of other languages instead are increasing. So for instance, the place of Chinese is increasing. Just looking at these statistics, you realize, you know, the real things. You realize a host of just not much less debatable things than just, hey, English is going down the hill because its rate of preponderance on the internet is going down. That's just not the full story. So look at the details, dig up the real things, dig up the, you know, stories behind the news maybe. Educate yourself by those beautiful online courses that can be found nowadays. You know, learn to program maybe, try out things, experiment with them, build your own opinion. This is the advice that I would go for. So a definitely empirical one.
And I just add my two cents to it. Well articulated, Sebastian. But I'd also add the fact that focus on fundamentals. Like even before we are having any conversation about AI, machine learning, I know people you cannot learn from news articles about AI and have conversations and take a stand on it unless you understand the real fundamentals. And the more you are like, okay, sure, we have spent years to understand this whole piece, and now I see the point that, hey, when is AI not just AI, it's just statistics put in a beautiful way, right? So just those fundamentals have to be solid in order for you to distinguish between what is essentially machine learning, when A plus A can be done by a human and when you actually need a machine to do this kind of work. So I would highly encourage the same pieces, as well as, even if you don't do coding, just understanding the fundamentals, even from mathematical standpoint, I feel that that's so important and so integral to having any intelligent conversation around effectiveness and usage of AI.
Excellent. And panelists, I wanted to,
I'm just going to say, like, what works for me, and I suggest this everybody, like, these people has way, 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 way more experience than me on AI. I can tell you what I've done. For me, rather than first thinking like, oh, I need to learn AI because, like, everybody's talking about it and it's something that I should do, I always suggest people to experiment and play around with those ideas first. So do like a weekends project with some TensorFlow repository or something else out there that you can play with. You can get a grasp on that. And then like keep going as Sebastian was saying, like more empirical. And then once you discover like, wow, this is exciting, this is something that excites me a lot and I'm obsessed about it, then just go deeper on the fundamentals and take it more seriously as a career change or something that you actually want to take it more, you know, long-term.
Well, wonderful, Jorge. I want to thank our panelists for joining. I do want the machine to have the last word in our panel. And so in preparation for this, I went to Lumos Learning. First, I put the description of our panel into the box and it gave me a question. Then I took Carol Jin's article that was written in multilingual and dropped it into the box and it gave me a ton of questions based on that content. So the question I want to leave you all with from the machine is, what is the name of the panelist that will make the understanding of AI a reality? Thank you all.